Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated October 22nd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. From the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, above the fold, Cree's Biggest Shareholder Reduces Stake, by Frank Van Luan. From Durham, quietly, Cree Incorporated, its largest shareholder, has sold more than $400 million of the company's stock in recent quarters. Fidelity Management and Research Company, the investment advisory arm of Fidelity Investments, has sold more than 7 million shares in the Durham LED Lighting Company stock in the past two quarters, slashing its Cree holdings by more than 40%. Call it profit-taking, but when a fast-growing company's largest shareholder, holding almost 15% of the company, reduces its exposure by such a large margin and at such a rapid pace, it is often an indication of the industry's future. Yar Reiner, an analyst for Oppenheimer and Company, cites the nature of the semiconductor sector. Almost every semiconductor market goes through cycles, Reiner says. The LED market right now is going through a down cycle. There's nothing surprising or unusual about that. When Cree's stock hit $83 a share in April, it proved to be the peak. With Cree's stock now trading at about $50 a share, FMR's remaining 8.6 million shares are valued at about $431 million. FMR remains Cree's largest shareholder. In recent days, some Cree analysts have started to get off the bandwagon, saying the stock is too hot and valued too high, putting the entire semiconductor industry under scrutiny from mutual fund managers. Other market observers don't see any connection between FMR sales and the swoon in Cree's share price from the $80 range to the $50 range. Kevin Pratke, a securities lawyer at Williams Mullen Law Firm in Raleigh, says of FMR sales, if the stock has had a significant run-up, it might be just a little profit-taking. Cree has been reporting record revenue quarter after quarter, results driven by the company's sales of its LED lighting products. For the company's fiscal first quarter 2011 earnings, Cree on October 19th reported revenue of $268.4 million, a 59% year-over-year increase and the highest quarterly revenue in the company's history. But analysts had expected revenue of about $278 million. That shortfall was enough to send Cree's stock tumbling by more than 9%. Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda told analysts that revenue hit the low end of the company's target because of a decline in sales of the company's LED chips. But he said LED lighting adaptation continues to grow. Reiner says the supply of LEDs had gotten a little ahead of demand and the market needs to rebalance itself. Reiner, who owns no shares in Cree, says Cree's slowdown in sales for LEDs used in computer monitors and televisions was not a surprise, considering that competitors in that space have caught up. That's why Cree has decided to focus on LED general lighting, which is still growing. Philips LEDs, LumiLEDs, and Osram are competing with Cree in that space. Still on the front page, sure, passengers hate them, but airlines love fees. By Chris Basden. From Morrisville. Flyers peeved about checked bag fees, pillow fees, or paying for a soda may not know it, but they are griping about what has become a lucrative and growing revenue stream for the airline industry. What's known today as ancillary revenue was virtually unknown a few years ago because such few fees existed. But given the increasing implementation of them, two consulting firms have begun tracking the fees. And, buckle up for this one, a new study of airline ancillary revenue estimates that the industry this year will rake in $22.6 billion in the form of various and sundry fees. The estimate was calculated by travel technology firm Amadeus and the airline consulting company IdeaWorks. The firm estimate that a 25% increase is over in 2009. Ancillary revenue has had a very positive impact on the balance sheets of airlines, says Jay Sorensen, president of IdeaWorks. Which major carriers serving Raleigh-Durham International Airport do the best when it comes to generating ancillary revenue? According to IdeaWorks, United is tops, having generated 11.5% of its total revenue, or 23.7 cents per passenger. From ancillary sources in 2009, AirTran was next with 11%, followed by JetBlue with 10.7%. Southwest, which has resisted jumping on the checked baggage fee bandwagon, was near the bottom with just 2.9%, or $3.53 per person, coming from ancillary revenue. Ancillary revenue includes many different revenue streams, but the ones that have gotten the most attention from passengers are the relatively recent efforts at a la carte pricing, sometimes called unbundling, which is breaking out the charges for optional services from the basic fare. Examples of this include charging for meals, extra legroom, and most notably, checking bags. The Air Transport Association, a trade association for airlines, says domestic checked bag fees total $275 million in September alone. Many customers decry paying fees for goods or services that just a few years ago were covered by the fare, and some complain that the additional fees skew price transparency. It's really just a hidden fare increase is what it is, says consumer advocate Christopher Elliott. These are things that really should be part of the airline ticket. Airlines see things differently. Delta spokeswoman Betsy Talton says the carrier is offering customers options and points out there. There is a list of fees on the company's website. It's important that Delta remains competitive, and we are competitive with the options we offer customers today, she says. Whether customers like the fees or not may be immaterial at this point, since they are helping an industry that lost billions of dollars in the last decade return to profitability. These fees are not going to ever go away, says Bob Erst, who runs airline consulting firm AirlineFinancials.com. He adds that on a per-mile basis, fares today are the same as they were 20 years ago. The fares are cheaper than they would be without these fees, he says. Along with unbundling, the other sources of ancillary revenue for airlines can include selling frequent flyer miles to other companies for use in promotions, providing advertisers opportunities such as onboard magazines or plane wraps, and generating commissions by helping to sell services for other travel-related businesses, such as offering an option to book a hotel or rental car at the same time passengers reserve an airline ticket. From the center of the front page, going halfway back, Northerners who move to Florida to work move here to retire, by Chris Basden. From Cary, about a year ago, Mark Hellerman and his wife Roberta packed up their bags to move out of Plantation, Florida. Hellerman, a native New Yorker, was retiring as a dentist, and the couple wanted to start the next stage of their lives together in some place other than the Sunshine State. The Hellermans wanted to relocate to a place with cultural opportunities. The couple also preferred to be near a major airport so they could visit their grandchildren, who live in three different states. And after 26 years in tropical Florida, distinct seasons would be a nice touch. When it came time to make a decision, the Hellermans picked Cary as their new home, and they're glad they did. "I like the climate," says 62-year-old Hellerman, who also enjoys the cultural offerings available at venues such as the DPAC. "I like the people I've met." And how long do they plan to live here? "Till death do us part," he says. It's no secret that North Carolina, and the Triangle in particular, have experienced a great wave of population inflow in recent years. According to the U.S. Census figures, North Carolina added more than 1.3 million people over the past decade, growing from 8 million in 2000 to nearly 9.4 million in 2009. Many of those have been drawn by the prospects of new jobs in the Triangle or in Charlotte. At least that was the case before the recession put the kibosh on growth. But there is a smaller group that includes retirees like Hellerman. And where did they come from? Florida was the number one feeder state, with 38,188 moving from the Sunshine State. People moving from Florida to North Carolina are often dubbed halfbacks, because many originally moved down to Florida from northern states, only to come halfway back by moving to North Carolina. New York, 26,319, and Virginia, 22,413, were the second and third largest feeder states. Wake County attracted 21,106 of those 55-plus who relocated tops in the state. The retiree group is what Dan Owens thinks the state needs to do a better job of targeting. It's a fast-growing market with people with money, says Owens, the Charlotte-based director of the National Active Retirement Association. We have no strategy to appeal to that group. Owens' pitch is simple. Attracting retirees is good for North Carolina's economy. They've had a lifetime to save money, which they are now able to spend on houses, health care, resort activities, and all kinds of consumer spending. Plus, retirees don't have school-aged children, so unlike many of the other people moving to North Carolina, the state won't have to devote resources to educating their kids. The North Carolina Department of Commerce doesn't have programs that are specific to attracting seniors. Spokesman Justin Guillory says the department markets to all people, and a lot of those things we do market would be of interest to seniors, he says. In the past decade, about 230,000 people age 55 or older have relocated to North Carolina from another state and obtained a driver's license, according to an analysis of North Carolina Department of Motor Vehicles data conducted by Owens. The Triangle is an attractive location for seniors for several reasons, including its strong health care facilities, universities that provide cultural opportunities, and the presence of a major airport. In some cases, it is now home to kids and grandchildren of seniors looking to relocate. Carla Savella, the vice president of sales and marketing for Michigan-based home builder Pulte Group Incorporated's local operations, knows the benefits of targeting seniors as customers. The company's Carolina Preserve by Del Webb at Amberley Retirement Community, which is where Hellerman lives, has done very well catering to that demographic. If we have an opportunity to do another one, we'd do it in a heartbeat, she says. At the bottom of the front page, Duke's stimulus millions being audited by Fed, by James Gallagher. From Durham, federal auditors are examining the work of Duke University researchers to assure that more than $213 million in stimulus funding they have received, among the most of any university in the country, has been properly spent. Donald White, a spokesman for the Office of Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, says the purpose of the audit is to look for waste, fraud, and abuse. White says he cannot comment specifically about Duke, but was speaking generally about stimulus funding audits. Jim Seidel, Duke's Vice Provost for Research, says there is nothing unusual about the review and the university expected it. We all knew there was going to be close scrutiny of ARRA, known as American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, funding. The more successful you are at getting ARRA funds, the more likely you are going to be audited. That's not necessarily the case, says White. He says the amount of dollars granted generally is not a reason for an audit, though he adds that to utilize resources effectively, it makes sense to conduct audits where there are significant federal investments. Since the beginning of the year, the OIG for the DHHS has completed nearly 90 audits and inspections of organizations that received stimulus dollars, according to the reports on the department's websites. White says that many of the audits were initiated because of the funding agency, such as the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation, asked the OIG to do an audit to look for problems. Other audits have been initiated because someone in one of the OIG's regional offices saw something that piqued their curiosity. Any abuse or fraud found in an audit is reported to the funding agency and to Congress and could lead to reduced federal funding in the future or even criminal charges, though that is a rare occurrence, says White. Seidel says he believes Duke has done everything it can to meet compliance requirements, including filing quarterly reports regarding its funding expenditures. Despite those efforts, he expected to be audited due solely to the amount of money the university has received. The audit is focusing on whether Duke researchers are spending the money correctly, are keeping sufficient track of their spending, and are complying with the terms of the grants. Among those whose work is being scrutinized is Scott Collins, a professor of psychology at Duke University Medical Center, who received $500,000 to study why those with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder tend to smoke more than those without the condition. Collins says the scrutiny isn't necessarily a bad thing. A, I think it's very well justified, he says, and B, it hasn't hindered any of the other work that we are doing. Still, Collins is painfully aware that strings are attached to federal grants. His grant came from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which gave him the choice of filing more paperwork to extend his work for a 4-year study. Rather than do the paperwork, he compressed his work into 2 years. It was going to be more work and a longer process before we were able to start, so we took the bird in the hand, he says. The results of the Duke audit should be posted to the DHHOIG's website once it is completed. Next article, Students Not Sold on Plans for Their Building, by James Gallagher. From Chapel Hill, UNC Chapel Hill is gearing up for an $18.8 million renovation of the institution's nearly 50-year-old student union, though a large part of the project could be derailed by students who will be asked to help pay for it. The university wants to bring the facility up to modern building codes, add 2 eateries, move and expand performance space, and create an innovation center. The projects would be funded through student fees, and this would be the first update to the facility since the renovation to the first and second floors of the original 1960 structure earlier this decade, says Anna Wu, Director of Facilities Planning. But students have expressed concerns about what they say is a lack of details regarding the second phase of the project and have threatened to veto a fee increase. It's very clear that renovations are needed and the space is being underutilized. So it needs some renovation in some capacity, says Holly Boardman, Vice President of UNC's Student Government. But the point of concerns were that, from the students' perspective, we didn't see where the money would be going and what we would be getting out of the fee. The first phase of the project, for which students have approved funding, consists of $6 million worth of upgrades, such as installing fire sprinklers that would bring the building in line with modern building codes. Also approved is $1.5 million to construct a Wendy's restaurant. The more expensive second phase of the project is what has students concerned. Chris Payne, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, says the $11.3 million second phase would consist of moving and expanding UNC's Cabaret Performance Center, adding performance space, practice spaces, and constructing an innovation center and adding a second, smaller eatery, such as a coffee shop. The project would work out to a cost of $31.50 per student in fees, though the total recreation center and student union debt fees would grow by only $16, from $80.75 to $96.75 in the fall of 2011. That's because the university is retiring some debt worth $15.50 per student, says Payne. The Student Fee Advisory Subcommittee of the Student Government has conditionally approved the $16 fee increase to fund the second phase. The fee will be put in front of the larger student body for approval, and it will be up to the administration to explain their plans for the second dining option and what would go into the Innovation Center, says Boardman. Innovation has been a hot topic at UNC of late. The university announced in September a campaign to raise $125 million Innovation Fund. And Chancellor Holden Thorpe and Buck Goldstein, the university entrepreneur in residence, recently released a book about how universities should be more entrepreneurial and innovative. But student leaders say the purpose of an innovation center in the student union and how it could benefit students has not been adequately explained. Boardman says she has heard everything from the center being a study space, to offices, to a space for student ventures, to a technology center. There are a lot of options, but it still is all over the place, she says. Payne says the Innovation Center mostly likely would be a student work area that is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that has some usable technology. Students have indicated the desire and need for space that is safe, welcoming, and inclusive that they can go to late in the evening, like 2 in the morning, he says. UNC currently lacks workspace open at all hours, 7 days a week. Next up, SBA loans up, but dollars are not. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. More Triangle businesses and executives were granted United States Small Business Administration loans over the past 12 months than the year before, but the amount of cash pumped into the local economy because of the deals dipped by 1.7%. SBA officials released the numbers in a look back at the agency's recently completed 2010 fiscal year, which ended September 30th. In a time of tight to all but frozen credit, the report shows SBA helped stage at least the beginnings of a thaw. Lending activity increased in both the Triangle and the state compared to 2009, but it still lagged the levels in 2008 before the worst effect of the financial crisis and recession took hold. Lending in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties rose to 248 loans during the 12 months of fiscal 2010, up by 33.3% from the 186 loans made in 2009. However, the cash attached to the 2010 deals fell to $57 million, down by $1 million from the prior year. As for the state as a whole, the number of SBA loans granted increased to 1,221 in fiscal 2010, up by 33% over the previous year. The cash volume of the deals rose by 18% to $312 million. Encouraged by the 2010 numbers, Charlotte SBA office spokesman Mike Hernandez says the agency hopes to see more of the same in the coming months. The SBA, based in Washington, D.C., doesn't lend money directly to companies and individuals. Rather, it works through banks and other private, non-bank lenders, which issue the loans that are guaranteed by the federal government. The guarantee rate varies, but it currently can be as high as 90% of the principal. SBA's best-known 7A lending program provides loans for a variety of purposes. General business costs that include working capital, machinery and equipment, furniture and fixtures, land and building, leasehold improvements, and debt refinancing. The agency's 504 program provides fixed-rate, long-term financing for real estate and equipment purchases. In addition to the total loan numbers, the Charlotte SBA office revealed the state's most active SBA lenders for 2010. Triangle banks making the list for 7A loans were, in ninth place, RBC Bank of Raleigh, 24 loans for $5.8 million. 13th place, Capital Bank, 17 loans for $2.1 million. 17th place, Self-Help Credit Union of Durham, 15 loans for $685,000. 26th place, Crescent State Bank, 8 loans for $1.47 million. 29th place, First Citizens Bank, 7 loans for $1.8 million. And 32nd place, Coastal Federal Credit Union, 6 loans for $224,000. Among the most active 504 lenders were First Citizens with 25 loans in 2010 valued at $11 million, and Durham-based Self-Help Ventures Fund with 37 loans valued at $22 million. In May alone, according to Self-Help's Jim Overton, the credit union made 13 of the 504 loans valued at nearly $10 million, creating an estimated 200 jobs. Recent federal rules changes aimed at getting more credit out to smaller firms raised the cap on 7A loans from $2 million to $5 million, waived loan fees until the end of the year, and extended the maximum federal grant, the federal loan guarantee, to 90% from 75%. That 90% guarantee is set to expire by December 31st. Stephen Marinari of Raleigh-based Diamond Financial Services believes the 90% guarantee needs to be continued at least throughout 2011. Continuing with new ratings methods, WUNC moves into top five area stations by Chris Basden. Chapel Hill. A change in the way Arbitron collects data for radio ratings has been a huge boon to the public radio station WUNC FM 91.5, which now shows up as a top five station in the market after previously not having been listed at all. Arbitron, a Columbia, Maryland-based media and marketing research company, recently switched its data collection method in the Triangle from a diary system, in which people took notes about what station they listened to during the week, to the portable people meter. The PPM is an electronic device roughly the size of a cell phone that automatically tracks the station that its wearer can hear. While data always have been collected on public radio stations, they traditionally have not been listed in the diary results. Arbitron has been changing that policy as it's been converting markets to PPM, a shift that occurred locally over the summer. WUNC-FM, which is licensed to UNC Chapel Hill, is now showing up in a big way, having scored a 7.5 share in the overall ratings for September, good enough for fifth place in the Triangle. That is just confirmation that they are a massive factor in the market, says Capital Broadcasting Company Vice President George Habel, a local radio insider who oversees CBC's sports radio stations. WUNC General Manager Connie Walker says the ranking wasn't a surprise to those at the station, who knew it was doing well thanks to a combination of listener loyalty and strong programming. It is a great public radio market, Walker says. Will WUNC's performance in the rankings have a financial impact? The station has a budget of $7.2 million, with about one-third of the revenue coming from advertising. Listener contributions account for the biggest share at just over 50%. Walker says WUNC managers haven't talked about raising advertising rates in the wake of the station's number five position in the Arbitrons. On average, the station charges $65 for a 15-second spot, with $125 being the highest price on its rate card. Andrew Latta, a media buyer at Cary-based MRPP, thinks there's an opportunity. I would not be surprised if they raise their rates in 2011, says Latta. The overall market ratings are based on the average quarterly hour share for people 6 years of age or older from 6 a.m. to midnight, Monday through Sunday. Aside from WUNC's sudden appearance in the latest Arbitrons, the top of the rankings contain many names familiar from the old diary days. Clear Channel Communications, WDCG-FM, branded as G105, was tops with a 9.0. It's all been real good news for WDCG, local Clear Channel boss Dick Harlow says of the radio station, which plays a pop music format. Radio 1 Incorporated, WFXC-FM, an urban adult contemporary station known as Foxy 107.1, tied for second with Capital's WRAL-FM 101.5, which plays adult contemporary music. Curtis Media Group's country juggernaut WQDR-FM 94.7 ranked fourth. While the overall ratings are a quick way to keep score, stations are often emphasize their performance with particular demographics to advertisers. Sports radio station WCMC FM 99.9, for instance, was number 15 in the overall ratings. That's not an impressive showing, but operations manager Dave Shore points out that the station was number 5 among men ages 25 to 54, a valuable demographic group to advertisers. I'm very pleased, he says. Pain not yet behind as stock looks to unload more space. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. The retrenching is not yet over in Stock Building Supply's 2-year reorganization, which has left the company 1/6 the size of its former self, and that could cause even more pain in the Triangle. Stock, which has its headquarters in West Raleigh, in 2009 restructured or rejected leases on a half dozen office and industrial buildings in the Triangle as part of its exit strategy from Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. In bankruptcy reorganization, rejection of a lease essentially means the tenant walks away from the contract and surrenders the space with no further payments. The company now wants to vacate 2 other buildings in Raleigh, and one in Wilson, and has begun marketing the space for sublease. The leases are for 224,000 square feet of warehouse space and 11 acres of outside storage at the BPG Beltline Center on South Wilmington Street in Raleigh that runs through January 2017. A 125,600 square foot warehouse in Wilson that expires in May 2015, and 8,942 square feet of office space at the Somerset Center on Falls of Neuse Road in Raleigh that expires in November 2012. The Wilson plant was closed after Stock's millwork operation was moved to the company's Yonkers Road facility in Raleigh and to another facility near Washington, D.C. In the Triangle, Stock still has retail locations in Apex, Garner, and Youngsville. John Kerr, president of York Commercial in Raleigh, who was hired to market the space for Stock, says Stock already has vacated most of the space. The new owner of Stock is making a lot of changes, he says. Los Angeles private equity group, the Gores Group, LLC, acquired 51% ownership of Stock in June 2009. The former majority holder, UK-based Wolseley PLC, has retained 49% ownership. At its peak in mid-2006, Stock Building Supply generated fiscal year revenue of $5.3 billion, employed about 18,000 people, and operated 320 locations in 33 states. In the Triangle, it employed almost 1,000 people at its headquarters and branch locations. At last count, in spring 2010, Stock employed about 3,000 full-time workers and operated about 55 locations in 12 states, or an 83% drop. Stock's Triangle employee count had declined to about 800 people. The company no longer discloses its financials because it is now a privately held company, says Stock spokeswoman Robin Fastenau. She also would not disclose an updated employee count. Fastenau calls the sublease offerings part of our efforts to streamline our business. We've taken the tough steps to right-size our business and are focused on the brightest residential home building markets in the country, she says. Our operating performance has steadily improved over the course of the past 12 months, and sales in the third quarter were up from the prior year. Bernard Markstein, senior economist for the National Association of Home Builders, notes that single-family homes starts are down by 76% from a peak in January of 2006. Next up, Cipher Optics gets $3.5 million as it hones security offerings, by Frank Van Leeuwen from Raleigh. Security and encryption firm Cipher Optics has hauled in another $3.5 million in financing to expand its offerings as the Raleigh company rides a wave of increased spending on security products. Chief Marketing Officer Jim Doherty says the $3.5 million in debt financing will be used to adapt the company's encryption technology for a cloud computing setting. Cipher Optics customers currently use the company's security devices and software on their own networks. Doherty says that as companies increasingly house more of their data on third-party servers, Cipher Optics is looking to bring its securities and encryption capabilities into this so-called cloud. The company is looking to hire software engineers to develop the cloud capabilities. Cipher Optics employs 48. Doherty says it's unclear how many new hires are needed, but the positions will be in the company's offices in Raleigh and Pittsburgh. Cipher Optics CEO Thomas Gill was traveling and unavailable for comment. Research firm Gartner says that although the economic downturn slowed security spending in 2009, security investments have picked up this year. Gartner forecasts that revenue generated by the sale of security software will pass $16.5 billion in 2010, an 11.3% increase compared to 2009. IDC projects the encryption market alone will reach $1.7 billion in 2013. Cipher Optics has raised more than $27 million in venture capital from Adams Capital Management, Kodiak Venture Partners, Origin Partners, and Axiom Venture Partners. IDC estimated that Cipher Optics' revenue was $10 million in 2008. Doherty declined to comment on revenue, but he says the company is close to turning a profit. The company has customers in 32 countries. This year, Cipher Optics added a new Taiwan-based vice president of Asia-Pacific sales. Wes Bjorklund, managing director of the Raleigh office of IT consulting firm Sonera, says security and encryption technology used to be common only in the military and government, but he says high-profile security breaches and regulatory compliance efforts now drive adoption of technologies across a wider spectrum of users. Bjorklund says that even in a downturn, companies need to invest in security. That's a cost of doing business in some cases, he says. The importance of security capabilities has drawn merger and acquisition interest among some technology companies. Symantec this year spent a total of $1.7 billion to buy PGP, Guardian Edge, and the authentication services businesses of VeriSign. Intel has entered into an agreement to buy McAfee for $7.6 billion. Fred Zeigel, analyst at Blue Water Capital Markets, says in a recent research report that large vendors such as IBM and Hewlett-Packard need to get involved in security M&A activity because of the growing importance and complexity of the technology. Bjorklund is unfamiliar with Cipher Optics, but he says a company specializing in encryption could be an acquisition target. Doherty says he's not at liberty to say whether Cipher Optics has been approached by anyone. While he acknowledges that Cipher Optics is working towards a future liquidity event, he says the company is not making changes solely to make itself attractive to suitors. We're not building specifically for an acquisition, he says. We're trying to build a successful company. Academic job scares for doctoral grads. With sour economy, corporate jobs also are at a premium for newly appointed PhD earners. By James Gallagher from Raleigh. Doctoral students and postdoc researchers probably will have to look beyond the field of academia if they want to land a permanent job in the current economy. Graduate students working towards their Doctor of Philosophy or PhD degrees and postdoctoral researchers traditionally have found full-time positions as professors at colleges and universities, but given shrinking university budgets, many professors are delaying retirement. There aren't many of those jobs available. Sam Bonfante, the associate publisher for recruitment advertising for the Chronicle of Higher Education, a major source for academic job postings, says that while the number of jobs listed has improved since 2008 and 2009, they still remain about 25% below pre-recession levels. If you are a PhD and you are thinking you want to get into a higher ed as a professor, that market is kind of scary, says Ray Engel, University Career Services Director at UNC Chapel Hill. What that means is that soon-to-be graduating PhD students and postdoctoral researchers whose projects are winding down will need to start looking for positions outside academia if they want to find a job, says Alan Kendrick, Assistant Dean for Graduate Student Development at Duke University. Duke is among the few institutions of higher learning nationally to have a career services department dedicated to graduate students. Most institutional career centers are intended to help undergraduates find their first job. The switch from academia to industry is one that can be hard to swallow. Many doctoral candidates entered their programs 4 or 5 years ago when the economy was booming and academic jobs were plentiful. They anticipated becoming college professors. Also working against the new graduates is the view that PhD certificates are academic research degrees and are not preparation for private industry work. That's especially true in the humanities. There is not a great demand in the private sector for people with advanced education in English and history, for example. Kendrick says that to make the switch successful, PhDs need to sell their skills in other fields. For example, an English PhD can reposition himself or herself as a technical writer, he says. For those in the math, science, and engineering fields, transitioning into industry and finding a private sector job is not particularly difficult. Many industries, such as pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and engineering, value advanced degrees in those fields. Private companies haven't failed to notice the lack of academic jobs. Bonfante says the Chronicle has received an increasing number of job postings from companies looking to hire PhDs. They're using the opportunity to beef up their workforce in PhDs. That's a bit of the silver lining, he says. During the 2009-2010 school year, more companies anticipated increasing their hiring of PhDs than those that planned on decreasing hiring, according to the Recruiting Trends 2009-10 report from the College Employment Research Institute at Michigan State University. But that could be bad news for those planning to enter the job market at the end of the current school year. Phil Gardner, the Institute's Director of Research, says that while companies will hire a certain number of individuals with bachelor degrees each year, many hire those with doctoral degrees less frequently. With a PhD, they may bring in one and not need another for a year or two, he says. Gardner says he is still compiling data for the 2010-2011 Recruiting Trends Report. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Salvation Army at $9 million in shelter drive. From Todd Cohen. While the Salvation Army of Wake County serves more than 90,000 people a year, the waiting list for its 34-bed downtown shelter totals 70 women with children who do not have a place to spend the night. The Salvation Army aims to change that by transforming the former Edwards & Broughton printing plant at 1863 Capitol Boulevard into a 41,000-square-foot Center of Hope. Scheduled to open in the fall or winter of 2011, the center will include a 92-bed shelter for women and children, as well as the agency's administrative offices, both now on South Person Street downtown. The Salvation Army in February launched a capital campaign to raise $12 million to replace and expand its existing facilities and cope with growing demand for services. Chaired by Jimmy Goodman, vice president of the New Media Group at Capital Broadcasting Company, and his mother, Barbara Goodman, president and executive director of the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the campaign has raised $9 million. With the average stay totaling roughly 90 days, women at the shelter are assigned a case manager to work with them on securing housing and child care, building their resumes, and securing jobs. And in the face of the troubled economy, the shelter is seeing women with college degrees who have held full-time jobs, but have lost their jobs or had their hours reduced and may not have the money to pay their rent or buy food, says Paige Bagwell, Director of Operations and Communications for the Salvation Army. We are seeing a different type of client, people who have never had to ask for help before, she says. The agency also is turning away at least 150 people a week who are seeking assistance with emergency needs such as food or paying bills in the wake of cuts by Wake County and some of the services it offers. In addition to Christmas activities, including distributing over 46,000 new toys and gifts to kids, over 7,000 winter coats for kids, delivering gifts to about 20,000 prisoners, and raising nearly $314,000 through its Red Kettle campaign, the Salvation Army visits 100 to 150 senior citizens a week and feeds 175 people a night at its soup kitchen. The total raised so far in the capital campaign includes pledges of $2.5 million from Judy D. Zelnak and Stephen Zelnak, retired chairman of Martin Marietta Materials, and $1 million from the Fletcher Foundation. And since February, the campaign has received pledges of $500,000 each from Wake County and the City of Raleigh, gifts of $200,000 each from the BB&T Charitable Foundation and the Stewards Fund, which made a challenge grant the Salvation Army met, and gifts of $100,000 each from the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina Foundation, Cardinal Trucks International, and the Temple and Carol Sloan Foundation. The new facility, which will be served by a new city bus stop, will be named the Judy D. Zelnak Center of Hope, and the shelter will be named the Barbara A. Goodman Women and Children's Center. Reading now from Small Business Money Matters, turning junk metals into gold, saving energy at the core of scrap recycling business, says owner, by Dale Gibson, from Raleigh. When Greg Brown steps into his Spartan office at Raleigh Metal Recycling in South Raleigh, he has to turn on the light. That's because he turned it off the last time he walked out. For a man who once had a job diving to the bottom of a cooling lake for a nuclear plant in search of possible damage being caused to the ecosystem, Brown might not be one's first choice to own and oversee two metal recycling companies, the others in Goldsboro, that slice, dice, crush, and compress millions of pounds of steel, aluminum, and copper each year, and ship the recycled goods to mills and smelters across the globe. I wanted to be Jacques Cousteau, Brown confesses in reference to the famous underwater researcher. The reality is I couldn't make any money, so I went into business. A graduate of the University of Buffalo with degrees in biology and business, Brown took executive jobs with GE and Honeywell before 2004 when he bought a company in Auburn Hills, Michigan called Ben Lee that sells roll-off trailers and trucks, dump trucks and the like, to companies that need such heavy-duty equipment, including his own recycling company. He still owns Ben Lee and spends 3 days a week in Auburn Hills to oversee that operation and be with his wife, Nancy, who is a professor at Oakland University. The other 4 days are spent in North Carolina running Raleigh Metal Recycling and Goldsboro Metal Recycling, which he acquired in 2007. He figures he works about 90 hours a week. But that's okay because Brown sees recycling as a business that has a high calling. And that gets us back to that light switch in his office. A self-described nut in the cause of reducing the nation's consumption of non-renewable resources to generate energy, Brown hands over a brochure produced by the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, Incorporated, Energy Saved Using Recycled Materials Versus Virgin Ones, 95% for aluminum, 85% for copper, 80% for plastic, 74% for iron and steel, and 64% for paper, reads the brochure. Plus, Brown says, it's now become less expensive to recycle than to begin with virgin ores. He explains, we pay cash for your metal trash, reads a single sheet, double-spaced, double-columned paper Brown hands over to that contains a list of 120 items his company buys, pop cans, roof vents, stovetops, cast iron, on and on. Once Brown's giant machines are done with all this junk, he turns it into another metal. Gold, with his recycling companies generating in excess of $30 million in annual revenue. Millions of pounds of his recycled metals go to fast-developing China each year. I'm exporting trash to China, and it comes back as iPods and flat-screen TVs, says Brown. The company also buys metals from various scrapyards, including Always Buying Scrap in Durham, whose owner, Dave Rush, says he enjoys doing business with Brown. He's a good guy. He helped me a lot, says Rush. Raleigh Metal Recycling, which has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau of Eastern North Carolina, accepts metal trash from all comers. The front parking lot fills with pickup trucks, sedans towing trailers, and vans loaded with junk collected by individuals. To the side of the plant, at the entrance of the 19-acre scrapyard, trucks of all sizes roll across weights, unload their bounty, and hit the weights again on the way out so the payout can be figured. Tearing down a building and need to get rid of the steel bones? Call Brown, and he'll dispatch one of his big trucks to haul it off and pay you to do it. Like most businesses, Brown's recycling companies were belted by the recession, and he responded by cutting the workforce by about 25%. Business has been coming back, he says. Ultimately, he wants to take in all forms of raw materials, from plastics to paper, for the sake of Mother Earth, and so he can keep the lights off. In the Workplace by Edward Marshall. Businesses need to find cures for organizational reflux. Yes, organizations have it too. Leaders complain about it all the time. They can't seem to get their people all headed in the same direction, especially at the top. The lack of alignment and ownership of the organization's core beliefs, principles, vision, and strategy are some of the major defining symptoms of organizational reflux. It doesn't take an endoscope for us to know that most organizations suffer from reflux, i.e., silos that create walls and competition between functions, even though they must work across boundaries in order to meet customer needs. Also, hub-and-spoke leadership that reinforces the silos. A performance management culture that reinforces independent achiever behavior and not collaboration, as well as a culture governed by politics and proximity to the senior leader. As with human beings, reflux left unattended can result in serious dysfunction. There is a form of Prilosec for organizational reflux. It is the creation of a highly aligned, collaborative and interdependent organization. Like, it starts with leadership. It starts at the top with senior leadership making a commitment to this cultural and organizational direction, a clear set of core beliefs, guiding principles, and a vision for the business and workplace are the cornerstones for organizational health. Also, an aligned workforce. Leadership engages the second tier of management in building a shared understanding and agreement on the direction of the business and the culture, and together they engage the organization, as well as transparent. Leadership is transparent in its decision-making and creates an ongoing process of two-way communications. Also, focused on the business. They harness their business objectives to that culture and empower teams to work collaboratively across the borders to solve business challenges. And finally, collaboration is measured. Measurement of collaborative behavior rather than individual and achievement is critical. There is a cure for organizational reflux, but it starts with senior leaders who make a conscious choice to move their organization in the direction of collaboration and independence. And now from the opinion page, from the editor's notebook of Saugata Mukherjee, Trees for Energy, No Shade of Green. It is ironic that I am writing this just hours after attending the 2010 Triangle Business Journal Green Awards Luncheon, which recognized the work of 21 individuals and companies making an effort for a healthier earth. Last week, North Carolina utility regulators stated that wood chopped down from trees in forests and farms will count as a renewable resource for energy companies such as Duke and Progress, which must work toward using more renewable fuels in the future. Essentially, the regulators are saying, go ahead and chop down trees, not saplings, not bushes, not woodways, but full-fledged trees, and then burn them with coal to get your quota of renewables. Currently, state law requires utilities to produce at least 12.5% of their electricity from renewable resources within 10 years. Obviously, environmental groups are not happy with this ruling since they argued that a law that was passed in 2007 allowed for the burning of wood waste and not for cutting down trees to generate firewood. While North Carolina has rightfully set up deadlines for electric utilities to switch to renewable fuels for a percentage of their capacity, cutting trees simply is not a solution. Now, electric utilities will be competing against paper companies such as International Paper and Weyerhaeuser to find forests and farms to cut down trees. The Southern Environmental Law Center, an environmental advocacy group in Chapel Hill, immediately went on the offensive and announced that cutting down trees is not a sustainable solution for electric utilities if the government wants them to wean off coal-based generation plants. With this ruling, the power companies may have found a cheap way to get to the 12.5% renewable target, trees. A Duke Energy spokesman already has stated that burning biomass, another word for wood, is cheaper than wind or solar power. This is sad because we've already gone tree-cutting crazy. Just look at the amount of sprawl we've created in the Triangle over the past two decades. Clear-cutting is alive and well in this state, with or without Duke and Progress. But do we really need to add a few more corporate powerhouses to the number of groups and companies that want to cut down trees? And more importantly, does it make sense to give a green signal to the method that actually may be detrimental to the eventual mission of building a healthier North Carolina? There's very little doubt the energy companies would promise the residents of this state that seeds would be planted at a much faster rate than the cutting down of trees, thereby reducing the environmental impact. But it takes a long, long time to grow a new forest. Besides the energy companies, another group, probably is ecstatic with this ruling, the timber merchants and the timber fund managers. According to the timber industry, more than $40 billion has been poured into timber-related investments over the past 20 years, up from $1 billion in 1989. Timber-pushing investment advisors claim timber generally has an inflation-adjusted return of 6% or higher. Perhaps North Carolina Treasurer Janet Cowell should look into investing in some of the pension money in timber investments and then funneling the windfall to start planting seeds all over the state. All kidding aside, it was a hasty opinion from utility regulators, and while they cleared the way for power companies to devise the renewable strategy, those regulators missed the boat when it came to protecting the environment. This week's guest column is from Ralph Davidson. Inspired Boards, Key for Nonprofits. Blockbuster recently filed for Chapter 11 protection, joining a list of failed, familiar businesses that bit the dust in the wake of the Great Recession. Nonprofits also have seen big changes. According to statistics from the National Association of Independent Schools, the bottom quartile of member schools experienced a nearly 19% student attrition rate going into the 2009-2010 academic year. Many of these same schools froze salaries, laid off faculty and staff, trimmed programs, shrunk annual fund goals, and stalled capital campaigns. Other schools, some in similar kinds of demographic environments at the bottom quartile group, had different experiences. Attrition of only 3%, hiring the best available teachers to lead robust curriculum, expanding annual funds and capital campaigns, raising millions of dollars in this same time period. So, what makes one nonprofit succeed while another fails? The answer, at the end of the day, going right up to the top of the pyramid, is an inspired, informed, and disciplined board of trustees or directors. Those of us who serve on nonprofit boards usually are asked to do so because other fields we bring some kind of expertise to the table. Most independent schools, for example, seek professionals, doctors, lawyers, educators, and successful business people to populate their boardrooms. But the skills we bring from our daily professions, as valuable as they are never enough by themselves to ensure a school's success. A successful school, or symphony, or museum, or hospital, any nonprofit, needs an inspired, informed, and disciplined board of trustees or directors. So, how does that happen? A board is inspired when it truly believes in the nonprofit's mission. It sees this organization as unique in its time and place, and the board works hard doing the work that only a board can do. A board becomes informed by learning best practices for trusteeship. None of us are born knowing how to be great trustees, and our professional or business experience usually doesn't speak to skills we need to govern a nonprofit effectively. We absolutely can learn these skills, but we have to dedicate ourselves to trustee professional development. Organizations such as BoardSource, the Association of Governing Boards, and the National Association of Independent Schools provide multiple resources for nonprofit governance, as do consultants, experts in the field. An inspired and informed board knows that it must be disciplined to move the nonprofit forward. Members aren't distracted by the issue du jour and are organized to work strategically. The board and the CEO develop a strategic plan rooted in the mission and designed around specific goals to realize that mission. Annual goals, both for the board and for the CEO, are derived from this strategic plan, and both the board and the CEO are evaluated according to how well they have accomplished these goals. Evaluation is used for learning, and the strategic plan is fine-tuned each year based on what gets done. All work and decisions are rooted in the mission, the strategic plan, and these annual goals. The only exception to this order of business is to deal with crises and emergencies. These do happen from time to time and must be handled in an organized and strategic and pre-planned manner. I work with schools and independent governing boards all over the world. Without exceptions, the ones that are thriving have boards that are deeply inspired, informed, and disciplined. They do the work that only a board can do, and without which the school cannot thrive. Schools or other nonprofits whose boards do not operate in this manner rarely thrive. They may limp along in good times, but in hard times they tend to go the way of Blockbuster. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleredingservice.org. www.creeonline.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.